Thanks for listening to the Jazz Joe Hall Show podcast. Today on the pod, what's in a name? Should counselors who aren't of Asian heritage be allowed to use Chinese names on the ballot? Plus, an RCMP veteran comes in from the shadows to share his 45 years of conducting undercover investigations from Vancouver to Muammar Gaddafi's Libya. Plus, Say It Ain't So, one of the city's most popular clubs, the Commodore, announces it's going cashless, even getting rid of ATMs. Vancouvers are riled up. Calm down, folks. This city can only afford one ride a week. That's all next on the Jazz Joe Hall Show podcast.
BC government about 90 minutes ago said they will resurrect a prolific offender management program which was scrapped in 2012 following a recommendation by an expert panel that studied ways to better deal with repeat offenders who commit random acts of violence. We, of course, all remember the slashing and stabbing of that Afghan refugee who just arrived in Canada in May. Public Safety Minister Mike Farmer said that the province will immediately act on three of the 28 recommendations made by Doug Lepard, a former Vancouver Police Deputy Chief and former Chief of the Transit Police, and Amanda Butler, who is a Simon Fraser University criminologist. Both were asked to come up with strategies to reduce property crime and random stranger attacks, which have plagued many cities from Kelowna to Vancouver. I don't know how many times we had callers for this show, guests on this show, particularly women who say that they live even downtown, but they're afraid to go out at night. So it's a real issue for many residents here in Vancouver and many residents in many communities in British Columbia. Here is Attorney General Marie Rankin, who spoke at today's press conference.
The expert recommendations confirm that these evolving crime trends that I've mentioned are very complex challenges. They're compounded, of course, by the pandemic. They are tied to recent changes in federal criminal legislation, as well as decisions from the Supreme Court of Canada that bind, of course, both the Crown and the police. They highlight the very real need to continue investing in social and health supports that our government has been rebuilding after a decade and a half of cuts.
That was Attorney General Murray Rankin. Joining us now is Colin Bazran. He also spoke at today's announcement. Mr. Bazran is the mayor of Kelowna and co-chair of the BC Urban Mayors Caucus. Colin, thank you for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you for having me, Jeff.
How important, in your mind, is this announcement today in dealing with repeat offenders, but also dealing with the bigger issue of random acts of violence that we're seeing here in Vancouver, and I'm sure you're seeing in Kelowna and Victoria as well? How important is it to deal with that particular situation?
These recommendations are important to deal with exactly the things you talked about. Not only repeat offenders, but random attacks that are happening in Kelowna as well. And we think that these recommendations are an important first step, but there's still a lot of work ahead. These are, in fact, just recommendations. There's got to be the political will and the collaboration of all three levels of government working together to really, put those recommendations into action. So while this is an important first step, where things really get interesting, or whether or not this is going to be taken seriously or not, is whether we see any actions or commitments made in future budgets of the provincial and federal governments, as well as through policy change.
This particular prolific offender management program that was scrapped in 2012, what makes you think it would work this time, and considering that it was scrapped the last time?
Jazz, in all honesty, I don't know the particulars of that program. So the recommendations have just come out, and that would be a question probably better served for Dr. Amanda Butler or Doug Lepard, the consultants who put this together. So as a result of the recommendation, I'm certainly going to be taking the time to learn about the history that this program had and what it may look like. But what I can say, though, with some degree of surety, though, is that a system like this already exists to a degree in a lot of our communities, where there is some case management, but where things break down is through the lack of information sharing of a particular client between industries, and things are very siloed. So I would hope that this would help break down some of those silos and allow, for example, RCMP to work with probation officers and service organizations and rehabilitation centers, where they can share information to make sure that the person that they're dealing with can get the best care, as opposed to things breaking down as they go through the system. So I certainly plan on learning more about that program in particular. Mm-hmm. So I can't really speak to what worked in the past. It was scrapped right when I became a city councillor. So I don't really have a lot of familiarity with it. And over the next days and weeks ahead, that'll be part of my job moving forward.
Can you give me a sense of what your community has been dealing with in regards to random violence? I can certainly tell you in downtown Vancouver, we've had many guests on our show talking about the significant amount of violence. Recently, of course, we had an Afghan refugee who was stabbed and slashed just as he was doing his job in Chinatown. Many women have called our show who live downtown or in and around downtown who were afraid to go out at night, something they would never have thought of 5 years ago. Is your community dealing with similar issues as well?
Absolutely we are. And I would say that sense of safety is the number one issue in the city of Kelowna right now and has been for quite some time. And I think, residents, myself included, are frustrated with what has continued to be a perceived lack of action. And I know our RCMP officers are frustrated too, because they're just catching the same people only to see them back on the street, sometimes hours later. So I think what we need to recognize here, though, is that, for example, in Kelowna, 15 people were responsible for over 1,000 touches with police last year. I would say the majority of those 15 people have underlying mental health or addiction issues or both. And so the question now becomes, sure, we can arrest them. And one of the questions that was asked in today's press conference was, should repeat offenders be given longer sentences? Well, maybe. But what we also know is that if they have an underlying mental health or addiction issue, how is it going to be solved if they're incarcerated? And if it isn't solved, the possibility of them being released and just falling right back into that life of crime is very high. So a lot of the recommendations that we're dealing with that have come out of this report are consequences need to be part of this, but also it's dealing with the underlying issues that's fueling it. Because if we don't deal with those, we're just continuing to perpetuate the same system that's got us to this point.
Mm-hmm. What do you say to the argument, though, that some have argued, right now the immediate response should be more boots on the ground? Part of it is obviously aggressive prosecution, jail time, you just mentioned that. But some have also said one of the other things we can do is immediately more boots on the ground just to deal with the lawlessness at time, the randomness of the attacks. Does your city, or do you think cities generally have the budget to perhaps deal with this in a more of an immediate way?
Well, I can tell you that in the city of Kelowna, we have increased our budget exponentially to help put more boots on the ground. And what we found is that it's not necessarily helping. It may help in that moment if they happen to be somewhere where something, criminal may be happening. So it may temporarily increase sense of safety in our community. But it goes back to what I talked about earlier. If the RCMP arrest an individual, but they don't get the help for their mental health or addiction issues that's making them act or behave in the ways that they are, then we could keep adding all the officers in the world, but it's not going to actually fix the problem. And so that's why these recommendations are supported by the BC Urban Mayor's Caucus. And that's why I believe that these recommendations will be well received by residents of Kelowna, and I think residents across the province, is because we have to fix the underlying issues. And again, don't get me wrong, that doesn't mean no consequences. I am a firm believer in consequences, but we still need to deal with the underlying issues. Otherwise, we will just keep doing this over and over and over again.
Colin, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Well, let's talk about names. A nonpartisan association counselor in Vancouver is coming under fire for her use of a Chinese name. Melissa DeGenova, a two-term Vancouver City Councillor and daughter of former Vancouver Park Board Commissioner Alan DeGenova, is one of 15 City Council candidates that will have special characters like Chinese, Persian, other non-Latin characters in their names on the ballot in the upcoming municipal election in October. Now, candidates in Vancouver's upcoming civic election will be allowed to have their names written in Chinese or Persian script, as an example, on the ballot after a judge adjourned an application by the city's election officer, which would have disallowed names in non-Latin characters. However, some are saying it is opportunistic of candidates to attempt to have languages other than their own on the ballot. Now, Vancouver's chief electoral officer had filed an application in provincial court last week to disallow Chinese and Persian characters. Now, the application included respondents such as the Nonpartisan Association's mayoral candidate Fred Harding, incumbent NBA and PA councillor, Melissa DeGenova, and veteran Vision Vancouver school board trustee Alan Wong. It said that all the respondents submitted their usual names to be used on the ballot papers in both Latin characters and other Chinese or Persian characters. There were 10 submissions. 10 of the submissions were from the NPA, 2 from Vision Vancouver, and 1 each from Forward Together, COPE, and One City Vancouver. So what's in a name? I thought it's a very important conversation. Joining us now is Will Tao, co-founder and immigration and refugee lawyer for Heron Law Offices. Will, thank you for joining us.
Good to be here, Jazz. Thank you.
Very interesting conversation, especially for a multi-ethnic city like Vancouver. What do you make of all of this? What do you say to those who say, well, what is wrong with having a Chinese name on the ballot, even though you may not be of Chinese heritage?
Mm-hmm. So I want to first state my position that I think, you know, that being able to name yourself as you wish to be named, it shouldn't be a right that's infringed. And I am very supportive, and I think that, you know, the efforts of election officials to allow for folks to use their cultural and ethnic names is much appreciated. And I think a lot about the work we're doing for Indigenous folks trying to reclaim their name and all the trauma from that. I think where the concerns I have are in individuals who may not know or may be, you know, leveraging their privilege to use names and may have not, in what I classify as, earned that name in terms of a proper process, or at least shared the story of the process of how they're able to use that name. And for me, if it comes down just to buying votes, I think that becomes problematic.
Mm-hmm. Now, some would argue, look, that our goal as a society should be to make sure we have maximum voter turnout. And that also means being accessible and making sure all candidates who do put their name on a ballot have access to those various voters. And that means those who may not be, and I'm just using the Chinese community as an example, could be South Asian, could be whatever it may be. But let's say for the Chinese community, they should be able to, those who have difficulty with English, have access to other names of potential candidates in Cantonese or Mandarin. And it shouldn't matter what their heritage is, because those names generally are given to them by other members of the Chinese communities in many cases. And this isn't the first time where we have non-Chinese candidates who are using Chinese names. It's actually quite common in politics.
Mm-hmm. And I think, like I said, I'm not necessarily fundamentally opposed to non-Chinese folks with Chinese names. I mean, if you're in China and you're an international student, or if you're working on business there, they're going to give you a Chinese name. Mm-hmm. I think what my concern is, and what other concerns of rightful critics of this are, is when someone who has never used, or folks who don't use Chinese names generally, mm-hmm. once every 4 years, you start to see the name popping up next to your name or next to your sign. And I think we have the, you know, obligation to ask folks who are adopting a Chinese name for electoral purposes, what else have you done, you know, to be able to utilize that name? And what else have you done to really be deserving of that name next to your English name or your regular name? I mean, at the same time, I think we should be asking also a question of why are you using that name that you've been given? Like, is there a story behind that name? Is mm-hmm. there someone in the community who's given you that name? And I think it's too easy to just say, I have a spouse, or I have a friend, or, you know, I have voters. I think because of the trauma we've been through as folks who had to change our names mm-hmm. to fit into white society and to, you know, hide our names on resumes, I think the reverse obligation should be there for folks using Chinese names or using other ethnic names to explain that story and face whatever criticism comes from it.
If you're just joining us, we are speaking to lawyer Will Tao. We're talking about City Councillor Melissa DeGenova. She's a two-term Vancouver councillor and daughter of former Vancouver Park Board Commissioner Alan DeGenova. She is one of 15 city council candidates that will have special characters like Chinese and Persian, other non-Latin characters in their names, on the ballot in the upcoming municipal election in October. This all occurred after a judge adjourned an application by the city's election officer, which would have disallowed names in non-Latin Latin characters. And the conversation and argument has been that if you are not of Asian heritage, you should not be using Chinese names on the ballot. Some are saying it is opportunistic of candidates to attempt to have languages other than their own on the ballot. Some have called it even cultural appropriation. And Will Tao, of course, is a co-founder and immigration and refugee lawyer for Heron Law Offices. We've been talking about this issue. Now, Will, I'm going to use myself as an example, somebody who has been elected before. Now, prior to elected life, I was a journalist for many years, 23 years. I was a foreign correspondent and at one time based in Beijing for Global National. While living there, I obviously lived in Beijing. I was a Beijing taxpayer. I lived amongst Chinese residents. And when I did arrive there, I was given a Chinese name by our producer, Zhou Haojie. And a lot of people who do work in China are given Chinese name, even though they aren't of Chinese heritage. Now, if I had decided to run for public office, should I be allowed to use that name if I'm running for office in Vancouver or anywhere in British Columbia?
Well, I think, first of all, I think that there is a bit of a difference in the fact that you are a racialized individual and that you have your experiences with your own name and your own prejudice. I think, you know, the whole idea, and I don't like to draw that parallel, and I think it's not a good parallel where you say, hey, you know, we always have, you know, folks from other countries coming here and having, you know, North American white names. Why can't we switch the other way around? I think it's a very fundamentally different power imbalance, story of trauma, histories, and whitewashing. And, you know, that all has to be factored into it. I think a white person has to have an extra level and a higher level of self-humility and grace when they are choosing to adopt that name. So I think that, you know, where the challenge is, and I don't think it's in, like, for example, if you want to use that name, it's a name that you know, were given when you were there, and you tell the story of it, you explain your engagement in detail, and you're open to those who criticize you for it and respond to them. I don't see why that name cannot show up next to, you know, your ballot if you choose that name. But I think, again, the big concern is you do have folks who don't seem to acknowledge the stories, the trauma, especially when you're dealing with family names, right? And if it's, you know, it's different if you call yourself, you know, do a literal translation or give yourself a nickname or a moniker. If you're really adopting a family name, I think you really need to know the history of how those family names came about. I think you need to know that some of our names come from certain cities. I think you need to know that the second character of a three-character name may be a generational name, and that generational name cannot be used by everyone, and every generation it changes. And I think my concern with all of this is folks are just kind of adopting a name just to get votes and thinking simplistically that because they are Chinese and because maybe they, you know, want to see a Chinese character, that they're going to get a vote. And I think that infantizing of our community is highly, highly problematic.
You raised this issue a little bit, and I appreciate your response to my last question. We have two official languages in this country, English and French, and in this part of the country, we predominantly speak English, but as an official language. But in practice, we are also a city that where you hear Cantonese, Mandarin, Punjabi, Korean, the Philippine language of Tagalog, all of those languages that are spoken in our city, and many, many more, Urdu, Farsi, all of it. Do you think it's the right direction to go to use non-official languages on ballots? I know that's been allowed, but do you think we're opening up a can of worms over the long term? Or do you think this is actually a good thing for democracy in regards to voter participation?
I think it's a good thing for affirmative action for the racialized folks who've had difficulty being able to express themselves and put their names on paper, many of whom, including myself, you know, still on many occasions put my white name forward in order to, you know, try and fit into societies like law and politics and other areas. So I think it is very empowering that folks are now able and feeling confident to then be able to say, you know, I'm Persian and here's my name in Farsi. Or, you know, if I'm an indigenous applicant, this is my indigenous name. I actually want to go by that name as on the ballot, right? And I hope the voters can understand that and see the power in that. And I think that that should be supported. But again, you know, when it comes to someone who is white, who has had the privilege of being able to call their own name their entire lives, being able to navigate through different nicknames in different countries and be able to, you know, do that, I completely agree that someone like that who's chosen to utilize a non-white name should face additional scrutiny and questions. And maybe if they're just doing this for an election, this may be a reflection of how they are as a politician, that they're willing to just change anything or say anything in order to get votes. And that's where I think the voters need to have that consciousness when they go to the ballot and say, has that person really done anything for our community recently? Have they actually been active? Have they actually been engaged? And how did that name come to be? Do they acknowledge the privilege that it comes with being able to adopt the name without having to hide factors or, you know, the histories behind the name? Do they acknowledge it? I think that's important for me.
Will, a fascinating conversation. I really appreciate your time today, my friend. Thank you so much.
You're very, very welcome.
It's time of the week when we discuss all things political and local. It's time for the CKNW Global BC Civic Election Panel on October 15th. Of course, voters across BC will be voting in or out mayors, councillors, school trustees, and park board members. CKNW and Global BC have put together a civic election panel of experienced people who understand local issues and public policy. They'll be also joining me besides, of course, today on election night on Global BC as well. Andrea Reimer started her public work as a community organizer on issues of social, economic, environmental justice. In 2002, she ran and won a seat on Vancouver's school board, a first for the Green Party in Canada, and went on to be elected to Vancouver City Council from 2008 to 2018 with Vision Vancouver. Andrea, welcome.
Hi, Jazz. Nice to see you.
Nice to see you as well. And Calcium is a prominent Indigenous leader and current chairperson of the Squamish Nation Council. Calcium is also active in leading work on various projects and initiatives, including developing the 6,000 market apartment development at his nation's Seanok lands, the largest Indigenous housing development in Canadian history. Calcium, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Mary Polak is a strategic advisor at Maple Leaf Strategies and served for 15 years as an MLA and held several portfolios, including Minister of Environment, Transportation and Infrastructure, Minister of Aboriginal Relations and Reconciliation, and Minister of Health. Mary, welcome.
Thank you, Jeff.
All right. Well, let's talk about the issue of the moment, campaign finance reform. It's been playing a big role, certainly last week, after a homeless man found a document showing how much high-profile developers were expected to raise through their network of social circles for Mayor Kennedy Stewart and his slate. Now, no laws were broken, but many people say it's another reminder that access to lawmakers still comes down to those who can raise the most dollars. Stanley Woodvine was the individual who found the document. He is a homeless writer. He was a guest on this show last week. Take a listen to what he had to say.
I don't think any law has been broken, but I think people should understand, like as you say, how fundraising works, because while it's not improper or illegal, clearly I could not possibly bring in the number of donations that Francesco Aquilini can bring in. The question then becomes, well, this is another reason why you're going to go for big corporate donors, because they can tap their employees, their network, their suppliers, which ordinary people simply can't do. So how does a grassroots party even begin to compete?
Now, Kelsey, let me start with you. Corporate and union donations have been banned under the NDP government. When they got in, they accused the BC Liberals of basically having a Wild West mentality when it came to fundraising. The maximum anybody can donate per individual per year is $1,250, so just under $1,300. Some have argued, actually bring it down to $100 per person. Do you think that lower level of donation is what we should be looking at?
I think if you think about campaign finances and how campaigns in a political race are funded, it pays for a lot of things like getting a party's name out there, for engaging with constituents, for getting the message out there. So the reality is elections themselves cost money, and engaging in the debates that need to happen when we have elections also costs money. So whatever amount that you put it at is going to have either advantages or drawbacks on what happens. So for example, you start bringing in campaign finance laws that limit how much money a party can raise, and maybe voter turnout starts going down because that party is not effectively able to engage as many people as they would have previously. So that's a good thing in some ways because we have less corporate or third party influencing the politics, but it comes with this other drawback. So I think that you change it down, you're going to see other negative impacts. or you find other ways to address, I think, the concern around accountability about campaign finance spending.
Mm-hmm. Andrea, would love your thoughts. You know, and you know, my perceptions are there's a significant amount of scrutiny of federal and provincial politicians. I actually think perhaps we need greater scrutiny of municipal leadership. And what I mean by that is the decisions that local officials make when it comes to zoning, rezoning, and development, in some cases, can be worth billions of dollars over a few years. Should there be tougher transparency rules? Because, like I said, the developers that were there didn't do anything wrong. They were asked to bundle. They were asked to use their network of friends and family and work colleagues to raise that money. But should there be tougher transparency rules simply because some of the changes that elected officials at the civic level are asked to make or can, you know, lead to billions of dollars in profit for property developers? And that may impact how people view civic leaders as well in regards to funding.
Well, it is, I mean, as you pointed out, a relatively new phenomena to have any controls at all in place at the municipal level. So it's something that's been evolving. I myself was a very strident and ardent advocate for municipal campaign finance rules starting in 2003. So I've seen the issue evolve a lot over time. As you pointed out, it took till 2017 to get laws. Mm-hmm. They certainly weren't perfect in 2017. They were updated recently. So, you know, they saw the challenges in the last election and tightened it up a bit. And I do think there's further tightening that could happen. The disclosure aspect, for sure. So right now, there isn't a requirement to disclose your donors until after the election. I think most voters would want to know before the election who your donors are. We do have one candidate, Kennedy Stewart, who's also the one we're talking about in regards to the list, who has actually proactively disclosed, in addition to inadvertently disclosing, I guess we'll say, by losing the list. But I do think, I mean, there's other issues at play here. There's no perfect campaign finance law. I think the big things that make a difference are having the ability to give tax receipts, so being able to incentivize donations, which you have at the provincial and federal level. I think that you need those at the municipal level if you do want to attract the $100, $200 donors. And the other big thing is public financing. So where we've seen the least amount of challenge with the financing of elections is in systems where you get some level of public financing. As Kel Salem pointed out, it takes money to run elections. If that money isn't there, voter turnout goes down. And we saw it go way down in 2018, the first election where parties weren't the ones calling people to the ballot box. Somebody's got to put that money in somehow.
Mm-hmm. Mary, you've been a school board trustee and a provincial elected official. Do you think there needs to be greater scrutiny, though, of the civic level? You know, at the provincial level, certainly you have a conflict commissioner. You have to provide information in regards to where your investments are, what you own. And I know you do that at the civic level. But like I said, the amount of time elected officials have to deal with in regards to zoning and rezoning applications, there seems to be opportunity where there perhaps may be greater clarity, maybe a conflict commissioner of some sort. What do you think needs to change at the civic level in your mind to perhaps provide greater transparency for citizens?
I think it's the disclosure factor that I think that's a far way to go than trying to reduce the amounts. As has been said, it is becoming more and more expensive to run an election and actually to reach people. I also think that we have to be very sensitive to the differences that occur in election campaigns in a major urban center like Vancouver compared to a smaller rural community. We know that some of the first changes that were made to municipal election financing rules really made it difficult for the circumstances that people confront in rural communities. So whatever changes are made, we have to be paying attention to the differences in the different environments.
We're speaking to our civic election panel comprised of Andrea Reimer, Mary Polak, and Kelseum. Topic number two, our colleague Richard Zussman covered UBCM last week in Whistler, and I was speaking to him. And one of the things that he heard from attendees privately, nobody talks about this stuff publicly, not yet certainly, there are many of the officials there saying they're concerned over the number of far-right candidates running in their communities for city council and school board races. Some are running as a slate while others are running individually. Many UBCM attendees say they were concerned that the election of even one, maybe even two far-right candidates could significantly disrupt civic leadership in a community. Now, is this something we should be concerned about? Is this a reminder to us that populism can play a big role even in civic politics? Mary, let me start with you first and foremost. How concerning is this in your mind?
I don't think it's the running of them that's concerning. It's that if we as a public, and this is so true of municipal elections, if we don't get involved, if we don't get out and vote, if we don't check out the candidates that we're voting for, that's when you end up with election results that can be very skewed. If you have a very low voter turnout and then you have an organized group that manages to contact their voters and motivate them and get them out to vote, especially if it's a specific issue, that's when elections get skewed. So, I mean, the real message to people here, if they're concerned, is that they need to get involved, find out their candidates, get out and vote, because whether it's left or right wing in terms of the extreme views or populist views, these things happen when the general public doesn't get involved and stays home.
Andrea, let me go to you. Populism has been something we've been watching very closely in the United States. Some have argued it's washed ashore here with some of the trucker protests that we saw earlier this year. Some of it, many have said, we've seen in the conservative leadership race as well. Is this just part of the broader trend that we're seeing, and now we're going to see it with the candidates for civic election in many communities in BC, or such as Soji and some other things? Is this just par for the course?
Well, I think those viewpoints that the populists seek to represent, I mean, almost by definition, have always been there, right? That the point of being populist is to try and connect with some vein out there of sentiment that you're trying to catalyze. What's new about it is that previously, I don't think any of us sitting here would have thought that they could possibly be viable in an electoral sense, right? So they might be on a ballot, but it's, you know, a few hundred votes and then everybody forgets about them and we move on. I think the new thing is that after Trump and seeing the rise of the far right and populism in the States, there is a feeling that these people are electorally viable here. And I think what we've also seen, and again, using Trump as the example, is that democracy is vulnerable not just to low turnout, and Mary, such excellent points, right? It's when everyone else leaves the field that anyone can basically win a game if they're the only ones there. So we need to be there and fighting vigorously for a positive vision of the future that helps counter that. But I think the other thing that's quite dangerous about it is what we've seen in the States is that the normal rules of democracy don't seem to apply to the far right. So they use this almost like an icebreaker. They come in and start wedging out access to just normal channels. They discredit the media, so people don't have a second source that they can go to for credible information. And they take the rules and either just completely flout them or change them to advantage their interests. And I think that's what would be concerning to local politicians. I know you were talking about the billions of dollars that local politicians deal with, but the reality is that in general, they don't have the tools that you have at the provincial and federal level don't exist for local politicians to help prevent that kind of, I mean, here in Vancouver, we have one councillor who calls points of order so often in a meeting that it creates literally like days and days and days more of meetings than need to happen. And there's no real tool to be able to deal with that, whereas other levels of government have a lot more safeguards against one person or a small group of people being able to jam the process.
Mm-hmm. Kelsey, and what do you think needs to be done to engage a broader set of the public in civic institutions, including voting? And, you know, it doesn't, as Andrea said, it doesn't take a lot if you have a single issue candidate and can galvanize, you know, 15-20% of the population. They can get in, and some have in the past. What do you think broadly needs to be done for elected officials, people that are interested in getting involved in civic life, to sort of broaden this conversation where people feel engaged rather than staying at home? And when you do that, you do open it up for single issue candidates. I don't care if you're far right, far left, it doesn't matter. What do you think is missing in regards to engaging the broader public?
The heart of this question, I think, goes to the nature of our democracy and how much we as a society are really thinking about how to protect or strengthen our democracy and our democratic institutions. For example, there isn't often a lot of discussion in our politics, both provincially or municipally or federally, around democratic reform. And I don't just mean like proportional representation and voting choices, but actually democratic reform that's going to increase voter turnout, democratic reform that is actually going to create fair rules for different kinds of ideas and political views that represent actually represent our communities. And we also see this in terms of the type of representation that we might get into government. So, for example, there's been analysis that shows that not a lot of working class people end up in government. It's a lot of people in the upper middle class who have access to financial resources. So mm-hmm. when you think about, are we focusing enough on actually amending or reviewing or changing our democratic systems? We don't. But I think like voter turnout, there's a lot of other democracies in the world that get much higher turnouts. And that's, you know, we need to look at what they're doing and what we're not.
Mm-hmm. Calcium, Mary, Andrea, as always, thank you so much for your time. We've run out of time, but we will see you here next Wednesday at 4 o'clock. Thank you.
Thank you.
They say cash is king, but we certainly seem to be moving towards becoming a cashless society. On Monday, the Commodore Ballroom announced they are now a cashless venue, and that has a lot of people very upset. Our show contributor John Jang has more.
It's Vancouver's most iconic live concert venue with a 93-year history, and some of the world's biggest musical acts have come through these doors, including U2, The Police, Katy Perry, The Tragically Hip, and countless others. But today, the famous, the iconic Commodore Ballroom is under attack following a major announcement from Monday night.
We're going cashless. We're going cashless.
The Commodore is now an entirely cashless venue, and only major credit cards, debit cards, and mobile forms of payment will be accepted at all events. Naturally, the public has responded with poise and grace.
Ooh, you suck!
A quick look through the comments section shows that an overwhelming majority of people are not happy with this decision, with many people saying they are no longer going to give the Commodore any more of their business. It's a puzzling reaction, though, given that the Commodore is not the first venue in Vancouver to make such a decision. Back in August 2021, BC Place went cashless, saying that digital payments are faster, safer, and easier. And 7 years before that, the Squamish Valley Music Festival went cashless in 2014. Moneris, Canada's leading electronic payment processor, has a report on their website predicting that purchases made with cash will make up only 10% of money spent in Canada by the year 2030. The chief product officer, Rob Cameron, is quoted as saying that more young Canadians are tapping their cards to pay. It's a strong indication that mobile payments are going to see a huge lift. Their study found that over 25% of Canadians aged 18 to 34 preferred paying with a mobile wallet. Only 10% of Canadians aged 55 to 64 felt the same way. Also consider how grocery stores are changing all the time. Canadians are seeing more and more self-checkout kiosks which only accept electronic payments. Yet on nearly every single trip that I've made to Safeway in the past 4 years, I've never seen anyone get angry about it. Also consider the growth in food delivery apps like Skip the Dishes, DoorDash, or Uber Eats. They're all designed to be a cashless transaction. All three have exploded in popularity since the beginning of the pandemic. So why is this such an unpopular decision on social media? Here's one report from CBS News that might provide an answer.
Cash is king, once again in New York City. A new law just went into effect banning businesses from denying people who want to pay with dollars and coins. Andrea Grimes tells us what you need to know.
Joe and the Juice in Greenwich Village might serve up healthy greens, but as customer Erica Freudenstein found out, they don't let you pay with green.
Today by the app, because we knew yesterday that they didn't take cash.
Technically, that's now illegal in New York City. As of last Thursday, November 19th, restaurants and businesses must accept cash as a form of payment. Some had hopped on the trend of only accepting card or app payments. Bronx Councilman Richie Torres wanted to stop that as lead sponsor of the legislation.
I have constituents who have no access to debit or credit. And even if you do, there are some constituents, particularly the elderly, who prefer cash. The choice should belong to the consumer.
And who can forget the now infamous Rogers outage from early July, crippling major industries across Canada, including digital payments.
Yesterday, particularly yesterday morning, was a gong show.
Global News first reported Friday that North Vancouver's Delaney's Coffee House began issuing IOUs, or tabs, for its customers who could not pay with their debit cards. The next day, many had returned to honor their bills.
And I think that people appreciated the fact that we trusted them.
But by making the announcement on Monday, Live Nation, the company that operates the Commodore Ballroom, showed they're taking their own leap of faith, trusting the trends and technology, and moving to become a cashless business. And for this contributor, who very rarely carries cash, it'll be an easy transition to go from this over to this.
So, John, the general conversation around these the situation like this is that this is legal tender, but technically it's up to the business, isn't it?
Yeah, well, exactly. I mean, there are, like you heard in that clip, New York State banning cashless businesses because they feel like that's just not okay. So by law, all businesses must accept bills under $20 in New York. We don't have such a thing here in BC, of course, Jazz, so a business here can decide what they want to accept. Look, even BC Place now being a cashless operation, I really don't see the issue with it, but I guess I'm still young where I barely carry cash anyways, Jazz. I suppose for those that are older, that have more money on them at all times, more cash on them at all times, mm-hmm. it's more of an inconvenience. But at the same time, how often do you go to the Commodore enough to complain and be like, ah, this is going to really upset my day?
I was in Kelowna over the last couple of days, and I didn't take my debit card. And I felt really weird, even though I had two credit cards with me, cards that I use, it's no big deal. But I felt a little different going, well, what if I need cash? And it's maybe it's me, just my generation's a little different. But I can see that. But you're seeing a lot of older folks in stores as well. They're not even using – they are using their credit cards, but they'll use their iPhone, the iPad. The touch technology. So inevitably, I guess we're going to get there, and there's really no need to be carrying dollar bills around unless it's an absolute emergency. But I guess we're all heading in that direction now.
Well, I think that's it, Jazz. Like, my name might be John Jang, but I hate having a jingle jangle in my pocket because I'm carrying change, right? Like, nobody likes that feeling. And to your point about kids paying with phones now, like, when I went to South Korea in 2019, I was amazed by how many people were paying with phones, like, everywhere. Restaurants, convenience stores, different businesses, retail outlets. Like, everyone was just pulling out their phone and making these payments. I got to admit, Jazz, I haven't been that adventurous to put my credit card information on my phones yet. So I still use my cards, but maybe that is the next final step here before we all just become, I don't know, cashless robots.
Well, I saw it just the other day, the amount of people pulling out their iPhones to pay now with their credit card on there or the debit card. It's huge, and I think you're right. We're heading in that direction. I just can't see us walking away from it. And when you mention Korea or Japan or China or many parts of Asia where they haven't had they're developing very quickly or have developed, they don't even think about this. They don't worry about it. They jump three generations ahead of us because that's just how they do with it. That's just how they pay for things now. So I guess this is the way it goes, and we're just going to have to get used to it. And actually, it's kind of funny the fact that even ATMs are now just kind of viewed as old and irrelevant almost. It's quite funny.
Yeah, I mean, the great debate about ATMs when I was growing up was, what does the acronym actually stand for? Access to money or automated teller machine? You tell me, Jazz, it doesn't really matter because I barely use one nowadays. So for me, cash is king, they say. I'll stick with the prince or princess or dukes or whatever the royal family name is now. I'm okay with cards. And if that's the way we're all going, by all means.
Absolutely. Thank you, John.
You got it. Thank you.
All right. That's Jingle Jangle John Jang. Well, investigating white-collar crime, fighting with cartels, uncovering complex organized crime cases, and trying to find the millions of dollars stolen by Muammar Gaddafi. Kim Marsh has seen it all. Marsh not only did undercover work with the RCMP, but also ran the RCMP's National Undercover Program. In fact, he's had a 45-year career in the public and private sector conducting global undercover investigations. Today, he releases his new book called Cunning Edge, A 45-Year Journey Conducting Global Undercover Investigations. Kim Marsh joins us now. Kim, thank you for speaking to us today.
Yes, good to be here, Jazz.
So I guess the first question to you here is, what motivated you to finally write a book about your years of undercover work in the public sector as an RCMP officer and the private sector as well? What convinced you finally it's time to write a book?
Well, COVID helped with it. I mean, I had it sketched out, and COVID came along, and I thought if I didn't write it now, I never would. But the thought behind writing the book was because of the uniqueness of the undercover work done in Canada. The RCMP program was started in the 60s by a guy by the name of Abe Stanenko, a Mountie, and through the 70s, 80s, 90s, a number of young police officers like myself, I was a couple of years on the job when I started, went on these long-term jobs in different parts of the country. And as I went through life and worked with other police departments and gathered more experience, I realized the uniqueness of, first, the program. Most countries don't have that type of development. Canadian laws allowed it. A lot of countries don't have that luxury. And our vast country and the type of work that we did is extremely unique. So I thought it was a story worth telling.
How would you describe underwork today in regards to its evolution from the early days, as you said? How has it evolved, and how would you describe it today?
Well, I think it's much more targeted. The Supreme Court has made decisions that rightfully has compelled the law enforcement, the RCMP and others, to be very careful on their targeting of individuals to avoid agent provocateur, which is entrapment, to make sure you're going after a worthy target. It's not that we didn't have worthy targets in the past. Now it's much more selective. Mm-hmm. It's shorter term, and it's not the slogs that we used to have in smaller communities or different communities where we went and we didn't come home for several months.
When you say you didn't come home for several months, what impact does or did in undercover work have on you and your family, or perhaps impact on other families with other officers? Talk about a little bit about the sacrifice in regards to undercover work on one's personal life as well.
I was single during the years that I did undercover work, and so it was easier for me. So I would just go away and then come back after a few months. We didn't have any formal training to help us with the psychological part of it. That didn't come until I went to Ottawa, and actually it started before me, so I can't take full credit for this. But we started psychologists attending the course, helping us with selection and then post-operation assessments. So I think what the real issue was in those days is people were getting into that type of work that shouldn't have been there, mm-hmm. and consequently developed social problems and did have marital problems, drinking, unacceptable behavior. And we started to get a handle on that in the latter part of the 80s, from about 84 on.
Mm-hmm. When you're starting a case or an investigation, what kind of things did you have to go through in regards to isolating an individual? How did you go about playing that role? I mean, I find that interesting. It's part acting. At the same time, you're trying to build a criminal case, learn more about that particular case. How did you target somebody, and what is the process you went through as you prepared to spend time with underworld figures?
Well, yeah, one of the misconceptions is that it is acting. It's role playing. To act is difficult. Like, let's say, for example, you put on an accent, or you put on even a lip. Feel like you've got you can't consistently do it, mm-hmm. and you see it in Hollywood movies where sometimes the accent, you're putting on an Irish accent, for example, you've got it for a while, and then it kind of doesn't work all the time. Mm-hmm. So you get into a role, and how you do that is learn about the environment you're going to go into, types of targets you have, what their interests are, or what type of person it is, and then try to adapt to it so that you can make yourself more presentable to the milieu that they live in. It's more difficult, though, like if you have like 10, 12 targets, you can't adapt to every one of them, so you just have to try to fit into the environment.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. This is a bit of a broad question. Where do you think the RCMP is today as a body itself, not just undercover work, but in policing and in conducting big investigations? in regards to transnational crime, in regards to terrorism. Do we ask too much of the RCMP today to not only do what I've just described, but also local policing and many other things? Is it an organization that is stretched or at least not capable of doing some of the bigger operations because we ask so much of it?
Yeah, I think you have a valid point there. And policing now is extremely difficult. There's so much attention on everything that police officers do. And I understand that society has changed, but the model I don't think works. Federal policing, there's supposed to be a federal police department, but of course we know they're provincial municipal police departments, and they get stretched many different ways. And then how do you recruit people, train people, develop policies and procedures that are going to be consistent? And then how do you satisfy the political masters, at the provincial municipal level? Because they may have, or very often do have, a different agenda or objectives than somebody out of Ottawa that's dictating how police and Quebec. They only do federal work. PEI, Surrey PEI, it's a small town, and PEI is much different than Surrey, BC, where we see some current changes going on. And I think that it has to be revisited, it has to be changed. I know from talking to people things are underway, but I believe there's going to be some significant changes going forward.
We are speaking to Kim Marsh. She is the author of a new book coming out today called Cunning Edge, a 45-year journey conducting global undercover investigations. Mr. Marsh has obviously spent a significant portion of his career working with the RCMP and, of course, in the private sector as well. Kim, let's touch a little bit on white-collar crime for a second. When I looked at the financial crisis of 2008, and there was a lot of blame to go around, the one thing I found in the U.S. was, to a certain degree, they still had some high-profile investigations and convictions. In this country, you rarely, if ever, see or hear about high-profile white-collar criminals being charged or convicted. Why do you think that is? And maybe it's just my perception, and I'll admit it. But why can we not throw people into jail? Why can we not conduct investigations that see some high-profile people arrested and convicted? I mean, I think back to 10, 15 years ago, they even had a case against Martha Stewart, for God's sakes, and threw her into jail in the U.S. Why is it that we aren't able to do that here in Canada?
Yeah, I think it's more than perception. It's factual. It's not happening. And America, you can compare other countries to America, not just Canada. But I know the Canadian situation. Firstly, the laws haven't evolved. Decisions have been made on money laundering, for example, exclusion of the legal industry on the money laundering legislation, and the federal government could have stepped forward and made changes, but they haven't done anything, and there hasn't been any significant changes in the criminal code and the statutes that allow police to do investigations for many, many years. This government certainly, and the Harper government, tried to do some things, such as get one regulator for securities in the country, and it was struck down by the Supreme Court of Canada. Most things that Harper tried to do were struck down by the Supreme Court of Canada. But on top of that, the states have lots of state legislation. We have one criminal code for the entire country. They're just a different beast. And they have a motivation and will to pursue it. We don't have the expertise for financial crimes in the RCMP, and since 9/11, that's gradually disappeared. I know they do have some specialty units in the West Coast. They have the CFSEU, which is an organized crime investigative unit. But I can say with certainty that there's not a lot of expertise there. The federal prosecutors haven't prosecuted cases for a long time because the police aren't bringing them. I can say with confidence I don't think they have a lot of expertise, and maybe not the will, from what I'm hearing from people, that cases that are presented that sit and gather dust because in this province, and not all provinces are like this, you need prosecutor approval before a case goes to the courts. And I don't think the courts can handle it. It's complicated, very complicated to get cases through. And I, again, because they're not exposed to it and not experienced, the courts don't really have the capacity to handle them. And it's very, very expensive. You have to go abroad to get a lot of the evidence very often, bring witnesses in. And then you get things like Regina versus Jordan. After 3 years, you haven't got your case to the courts, it's thrown out. There's a lot of reasons. It's pretty much broken, I would say.
That assessment would have many of our listeners very concerned. It paints a picture of a country, in this case Canada, that is wide open to potential money launderers, white-collar crime, and other types of criminal activity, transnational crime. What you're suggesting here is a need for a complete overhaul in regards to how we deal with white-collar crime.
Yeah, in some places like the UK, for example, the UK's it's easier to police in some ways because it doesn't have the big geographical breadth that we have in this country, but they have a serious fraud office. I know there's some efforts, and it's still underway, I have to say. I'm not completely up to speed on it, but to develop a unit in Toronto where Toronto Stock Exchange and the financial hub is located for the country. But they got to get moving. And get some credibility and get some cases going so the public can gain some confidence. We're known as a pretty soft touch. And then to finish it all off, if you do manage to register a conviction, the sentences are lightweight. Unlike the U.S., where if it's a serious fraud, and especially if there's elderly people have been defrauded, and you see that often. It's very sad. Not much happens.
I do want to end this interview just talking about the broader issue, but are there one or two investigations you're really proud of that you really felt it was interesting, good work, whether it be in the public sector or private sector? I know you've done work in Africa, chasing after money from Muammar Gaddafi's regime, many other interesting cases. Are there any that sort of stick out for you?
Well, in my book, I feature some of them. I mean, the Libyan Gaddafi one was interesting just because of how it played out. I got a lot of satisfaction working abroad when I was in Miami and in London, working with investigators on both sides. Canada as well as other countries, because you were stopping not always convicting, but you were stopping crimes. And, you go through an investigation and you end up with a conviction at the end. I always said I like the thrill of the hunt rather than the kill. And if you're protecting society from nefarious characters, I think that's better than maybe always having a successful conviction.
Yeah. Well, Kim, fascinating book. I really appreciate you sharing your vast amount of experience with us today. The book is called Cutting Edge, A 45-Year Journey Conducting Global Undercover Investigations. It comes out today. It's a good read. I highly recommend it. Kim, thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate it.
Okay, yes, thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Jazz Joe Hall Show podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to the show on Apple or Google Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. You can always listen to the Jazz Joe Hall Show live Monday to Friday from 3 to 6 p.m. on 980 CKNW and connect with me on Twitter at Jazz Joe Hall BC. Talk to you next time.
Hi, it's Shauna, and I might be a bad parent because my kids think french fries are vegetables.
Hey, it's Ryan, and I might be a bad parent because I went out for wings when my wife was in the hospital after giving birth.
Johnny here. I might be a bad parent because in my house, the tooth fairy gives pocket change.
But we're not alone. Len emailed us and said his six-year-old daughter's Tarzan moment going from love seat to lazy boy by curtains made him more proud than any dance recital.
And Andy left his two-year-old at the rink.
All right, guys, I'm sure we're not alone.
Like Andy's kid.
For stories and confessions like this, make sure you check out our podcast.
It's called Bad Parents, and it's available wherever you get your podcasts.
I left a glove at the rink.